Previously on Beta.
Stay here. Stay as long as you can.
Unfortunately, by breaking quarantine, you risk everybody's life.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. And to all of you hearing this, we hope you're staying well and safe. Today on Beta, author Karen Tongson tells us about the powerful legacy of her namesake, Karen Carpenter, and the impact of the Carpenters' music in her native homeland.
So much of their music is about singing along and singing songs together, and the Philippines has a really deep and profound public singing culture.
And author Andy Green on how The Office overcame its mundane origin to become the greatest sitcom of the 2000s.
It was a show that didn't have stars. It took place in a very unglamorous part of the country at a very unglamorous job. And you couldn't think of a more boring premise for a show.
But first, Barry Sonnenfeld broke into the movie industry by working as the cinematographer on the Coen brothers' first three movies. He went on to direct The Addams Family, Get Shorty, and the first three installments of the Men in Black franchise. But before all this, Barry had to endure childhood and adolescence. And that wasn't easy with an overprotective mother constantly keeping tabs on him. He's written all about it in a book called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. And if you're wondering where the title comes from, that makes two of us. We zoomed in with Barry so he could explain.
Well, it was one of the more surreal moments of my life. I was at Madison Square Garden in 1970. I was a senior in high school. It was the first peace concert in New York. Peter, Paul, and Mary, the cast of Hair, all these other people. And at 2:20 in the morning, while Jimi Hendrix was warming up for the second time, because he had left the stage in a huff earlier, came the following announcement over the Madison Square Garden PA system: Barry Sonnenfeld, call your mother. It says so much about my mother. A, that she was that of a protective Jewish mother of an only child, that she could actually page me. And B, it shows how strong she was in her weakness to be able to find someone willing to actually answer the phone and agree there was something damn important going on that required me to call my mother. It goes downhill from there, by the way.
What was your reaction? Like, take me back to the moment when, you know, Hendrix is about to start playing and then you hear this announcement over the PA.
Well, so first of all, you start to cry uncontrollably because you realize the only reason that you would be page at Madison Square Garden is that your father has died. And therefore, I'm going to spend the rest of my life as a skinny virgin living at home with my overprotective mother. So also, by standing up, I have announced to Madison Square Garden that I indeed am Barry Sonnenfeld. So what starts in the cheap blue seats, which is where we were, but cascades down towards the red and orange, more expensive seats, is the Madison Square Garden chant of Barry, Barry. So now Jimmy has stopped. The garden is chanting Barry. And I am weeping uncontrollably. I get to the payphone. This is obviously before cell phones, or she probably would have texted me. And the next thing you know, I'm weeping, saying, who died? And mom saying, well, I thought you did. You said you'd be home at 2, and it's 2:20. I, of course, said, yeah, but mom, didn't they tell you the concert was still going on? And mom said, well, yeah, they told me that, but they couldn't find you. So that was my mother, and therefore that's the title of my book.
Right. That speaks volumes about what your mother was like. But what else can you tell us about her and your relationship with her growing up?
Well, you know, she was very depressed. You know, she spent most of her time in her bedroom with a wet towel over her face. She told me that if I went to sleepaway school, others call it college, she would commit suicide. So I spent 3 years of living at home attending NYU. I realized wait a minute, why don't I just go somewhere else for my senior year of college, and I'll get to both go away to college and my mother commit suicide. Two birds, one stone, win-win. So I spent my senior year at Hampshire College, and unfortunately, my mother reneged on her threat, so she remained a living entity in my life. But she was just very desperate for attention, and both my parents were very narcissistic.
Yeah. One of the things that caused a lot of conflict between you and your mother later in her life and in your life as well, you were saying that you wished your mother was dead during interviews. You'd say that like on Letterman and in an interview with the New York Times Magazine reporter. Why would you do that?
Well, no, I never said I wished my mother were dead on Letterman. On Letterman, what I said is that until he died, my mother could have been Vincent Gardenia's photo double. And of course, Letterman, because they pre-interview, had a photo of Vincent, and the camera zooms in on this photo of Vincent, and I looked at it and I said
that my mother had more facial hair. And again.
So that was sort of devastating. And then when the Times came out, she was pretty, she said decimated. I said devastated. And she said, no, I'm decimated. But the worst, I think, really, was Newsweek, when Men in Black came out, had a cover story on Men in Black. And in the article, it said that I used to walk around the set offering anyone on the set, grips, electricians, camera people, wardrobe, $400,000 to either get me kicked off the movie or kill my mother. And so this was in Newsweek, and Mom called me and she said, Barry, do you really wish I were dead? And I said, you know what, Mom? I promise you, I would never pay anyone $400,000 to kill you. And she said, thank you, Barry. I love you too. Well, listen, I sound like I'm a horrible, horrible son. And I have to tell you, I was, but my parents deserved it. So there.
You have 9 words that you use to describe your personal philosophy. What are they?
It's regret the past, fear the present, dread the future. Let me give you some advice. There's no upside in being an optimist. And I'll give you an example. If when you get on an airplane, you turn to your wife and you say, I don't think we're going to make it. I think this plane's going to crash before we get to Cleveland. Either one of two things happen. If the plane starts to nosedive to the ground, you get to elbow your wife and say, hello, am I right or what? Which is a win. Or you land safely in Cleveland, which is also a win because you didn't die. Win-win.
Oh, absolutely. That's my philosophy, too. And I guess we should start a cult, although maybe we should call it a religion so that we can get the tax breaks. And what do you think? I think we should call it Sonnenfeldology. How does that sound to you?
Well, or you could say that it's a Sonnenfeldian concept. I like the phrase Sonnenfeldian.
Okay. Yeah, I like that, too. Let's go with that. You have way more street cred than me, so I'm going to defer to you. You broke into the film industry as the cinematographer on Joel and Ethan Coen's first 3 films, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, and Miller's Crossing. How did you meet the Coen brothers?
I met Joel Coen at a Christmas party, and we were the only 2 Jews there. And we sort of could see each other from across the room and sense the Semitic nature of our being. We started to talk, and Joel said that he and his brother Ethan had written a script for a low budget movie called Blood Simple. And the way they were going to raise the $750,000 to make the movie was to shoot a fake trailer. Their theory was that if you're going to go to dentists and doctors and, you know, say we need $15,000 for a point, a doctor or a dentist can't read a script and know if it's any good. And they can't also read a script and say, okay, I guess you kids know how to direct. But if you shoot a trailer, all those investing clubs, you know, can look at that trailer and go, A, this looks like a good trailer, so they know what they're doing, and B, this looks like a trailer of a movie I'd go see. So I said to Joe, well, I own a 16 millimeter movie camera. And Joe said, well, if you've got a camera, you're hired. So we went out, we shot the trailer, we loved the way it looked, and we became good friends. And the first day of shooting on Blood Simple was the first day that Joel, Ethan, or I had ever been on a movie set.
One of the most, if not the most iconic shots in Blood Simple actually appeared in the trailer that you made before the film. Can you tell us about this shot and how you accomplished it?
Well, we did it two ways. We did it one way in the trailer, which worked much better. And then when we shot it for real in Austin, it was not nearly as good. There's a scene where Fran McDormand's character has snuck into the room next door, and she's hiding in the bathroom. And the killer, played by M. Emmett Walsh, is in the next bathroom, separated by a wall and a window. And Fran has slammed M. Emmett Walsh's hand down on a windowsill and put a knife through his hand. So Emmett is stuck there. So what Emmett's character does is takes his gun and starts shooting holes between the two walls. And he shoots so many holes that he's able to then smash his arm through the wall and remove the knife that's stuck in his hand. The way we did it for the trailers, we built a fake wall in Hillary Ney's loft. Hillary Ney was a woman who was having the Christmas party that Joel and I had attended. And we cut out big plugs and then filled them up again. So as the camera dollied towards the wall, there was a guy in the back behind this fake wall we built and would hit hammers into the plug, which would send the plugs through frame and reveal this bright beam of light. It worked great. When we did it for real, we had a real special effects guy instead of just Don, a guy with a hammer. And he set little charges in the wall, and that didn't work nearly as well as using the simple way. We always say that if we remade Blood Simple, we could do it for 20 times the budget and it would be half as good.
You made your directorial debut with the 1991 film, The Addams Family. What was the biggest challenge you faced as a first-time director?
Well, as a first-time director, the biggest challenge is working with actors. Because as a cinematographer, oftentimes the actors are those people that are less than helpful. But as a director, those are the people telling your story. So for me, the biggest challenge was, would I know what to say when an actor would say, why am I doing this? And for me, what I learned is if you just tell actors to talk really fast, that solves everything. It's true. The faster an actor talks, the less chance they have to act. And for me, I hate watching acting. I just like watching reality. So if an actor talks fast, it prevents them from stammering or taking times or reacting. So whenever I'm on the set, pretty much the only thing I'll ever say to an actor is, let's do it again, like twice as fast. When I'm directing two actors, the thing I say to them is after a take, I'll come up to them and I'll say, one of you was very good. And then I walk away, and they don't know which one I'm talking about, but boy, both of them try to do better.
In your book, you say that many books by successful authors are optioned before they're even published, which you hope is the case with your book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. So I got to ask, has it been optioned?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Warner Brothers Television and Rob Reiner, who's a friend of mine, are in negotiation to option my book.
Awesome.
We think it would be a very funny streaming show where you see how the past informs the present.
I hope that happens. And so who would you like to see play yourself and your mother? Would you play yourself?
No, I would want Max Greenfield to play me. He's a good-looking Jew, which would be fun. And unfortunately, because he's dead, we can't have Vincent Gardenia playing my mother.
Yeah, so who plays your mother?
I don't know, but we'll find an overweight, squat, hairy man to come in and play mom.
Yeah. Barry Sonnenfeld, thank you very much for the suitably Sonnenfeldian conversation.
Well, listen, this has been a total pleasure. I enjoy talking to you so much.
That was film director Barry Sonnenfeld. He's the author of Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. Find out more about Barry at WPR.org/beta.
And I think that she gave voice to that, in many respects, a torch song singer. And that torchiness and its kind of long association with LGBT cultures is one of the reasons I find Karen Carpenter has such resonance in LGBT communities.
Author Karen Tongson joins us to talk about why Karen Carpenter matters. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Karen Tongson jokes that she's been listening to the music of Karen and Richard Carpenter since she was in utero in her native Philippines. Her mother even named her after Karen Carpenter. Tongson says that the Carpenters may have even been more popular there than they were here. She explains why in her book, Why Karen Carpenter Matters. Part memoir, part biography, the book dives into Carpenter's legacy and how it isn't just limited to her music.
She matters in so many different ways for so many people. What I wanted really to focus on in my book was why she mattered to people who might be unexpected in her realm of fandoms, you know, or the amongst the fans who might be expected to like her music. The Carpenters are so often associated with a particular kind of middle American, 70s kind of wholesome and kind of antithetical to the counterculture vibe. To me, I think that one of the things that I take for granted is that the Carpenters, Karen Carpenter herself, both are so beloved by the Filipino people and by people of color and LGBT people, and that sort of fan base is not as readily thought of in relationship to the Carpenters. So I wanted to explore why she mattered to people who have identities that seem at odds with some of the things the Carpenters sang about.
Yeah, and I want to ask you why Karen Carpenter matters to you personally. Your musician parents named you after her, but there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more to that. So my parents were musicians. My mom and bio dad met as part of a large group called the Circus Band, who performed in Manila, known for original Filipino music in the 1970s. And my mom named me after Karen in part because her own voice was often compared to Karen Carpenter's, because she too had a low alto voice. And so in some strange way, it was almost like naming me after her, but mediated through this famous figure. So it wasn't quite a direct link just to her name, but to something that said something about my mom.
Can you take me back to the very first time you heard the Carpenters?
I always say when people ask me this question that I can't really pinpoint it, because I'm assuming I listened to the Carpenters in utero. My, you know, parents were listening to the music. That, you know, I was born in 1973 at the height of the Carpenters' fame, really when they were breaking out, making gold record, platinum singles, etc. And so I feel like I never knew a time that the Carpenters were not a part of my sonic landscape.
Yeah. The first Carpenters hit that was written by Richard Carpenter and his songwriting partner, John Bettis, was a song called Goodbye to Love, which was released in 1972. You say that it's one of their most innovative original songs. What's so innovative about it?
When we listen to it now with 2020 hearing, that's kind of fun to say.
Yeah, that's fun to hear you say.
Yeah. Well, listening to it many decades after something called the power ballad has basically become a standard sound in popular music, it doesn't sound that remarkable. But if you think back to 1972 and think back to, again, the sound the Carpenters were associated with, which was a certain kind of mainstream balladry, middle-of-the-road balladry. And part of what made it so innovative was that it was really one of the first hit singles to include a sawtoothed guitar solo, like basically shredding up the middle of a song that's otherwise quite placid and gentle. For those of us who've listened to Heart and Journey and everybody else basically from the 80s, we're trained to hear that as something that's always existed, but that's one of the first songs, if not the first song, to create that contrast and to provide that power ballad sound we all love.
You immigrated to the U.S. in the early 1980s, and it was around 1984 that you played that song, Goodbye to Love, for a couple of your next-door neighbors. Can you tell me about this?
I thought that given how much a song like Goodbye to Love sounded like some of the pop ballads of the 80s, especially Journey, who I already mentioned, especially something like Open Arms, right?
Right.
I thought that it would be amenable to the, you know, kids next door. We were like basically, I don't know, pre-adolescence or adolescence. And during a long listening session of listening to Journey and a bunch of other folks, I decided to play Goodbye to Love because I thought it was very much in keeping with that sound. And people were just like, the boys next door were like, what is this? Who are you? This is so cornball. Part of me was so confused, again, because of the sonic similarities, you know, between a ballad with a delicate piano and other instruments and then a big guitar solo. So, yeah, that was one of my first times of really acknowledging to myself that my tastes in music, the styles that I felt attached to, might be out of step with what the young folks of my new place that I was living in were into.
You write that although Karen Carpenter was supposed to be your gateway to a whole new world, she actually ended up being the anchor to your old world. Can you explain that?
The Carpenters, because of their ubiquity on Filipino radio, in Filipino popular music, on television, I just assumed that they were as enduring in the kind of soundscapes of Southern California in the 1980s. And as we just discussed, I found out I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I realized I was wrong, part of what happened is I realized how profoundly the Carpenters, to me, sounded like the Philippines and not the United States, that how it reminded me of home, of my family, of my earliest days, hearing everyone sing their music and knowing that I was named after Karen Carpenter. So it was a connection to that past in the Philippines, and less so a kind of gateway to the America that the Carpenters always sang about.
Mm. Why do you think that that's the case?
I think that one of the kind of historical reasons to think about why the Carpenters were popular in the Philippines is that Armed Forces Radio had a certain kind of playlist that it stuck to. And it was often things that were middle-of-the-road ballads, you know, kind of adult contemporary-ish songs, nothing too raucous. The whole movie Good Morning Vietnam is about that conflict, right?
Right.
And, you know, given that the U.S. had its naval bases and its influence and enduring influence in the Philippines, I think that's one of the reasons why music like the Carpenters and the Carpenters themselves were in such deep circulation in the 70s and during that particular era. That said, I think it also, you know, the Carpenters, so much of their music is about singing along and singing songs together. And the Philippines has a really deep and profound public singing culture.
Mm.
They just became standards because they were songs we could sing along to. Karen's alto voice wasn't too high. And
yeah,
even those of us who didn't have good voices could manage to match pitch and like share the sentiment.
I'm on the top of the world looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find
is the love that I've found ever since you've been around. Your love's put me at the top of the world.
So I do think that those things combined, that bit of feel and that bit of history, combined to create that ubiquity.
Mm. What was the relationship between Karen and her brother Richard like?
I think that they were extremely close. I think that he was her older brother and she sort of was his sidekick. Like that was kind of their vibe and that's how they were growing up. And I think that Richard's talents were very much fostered by the family. And he was always seen as the kind of primary musician. And Karen sort of fell into singing, fell into playing the drums, in part because she was supporting her brother. And so I think that it led to a different dynamic later on when Karen began to emerge as the person who people paid attention to.
Mm, yeah. I was surprised to learn how the Carpenter's mother, Agnes, totally favored Richard and basically ignored Karen. How did this favoritism affect her?
I mean, there's so many different speculations about that, that it's one of the reasons that Karen suffered from anorexia at various points in her life and eventually killed her. But I like to think a little bit differently about that, that it was more than just, you know, wanting love for mom. You know, there's, again, several other biographies and other news pieces sort of focus on that. But I think that it was a whole kind of ecosystem that that really pushed Karen Carpenter to not feel the greatest about herself and her body and her appearance. And there are ways in which I think she just sort of wanted to disappear from certain registers of attention. And that didn't really have to do with whether or not her mom had a preference for her older brother.
Mm. You say that straight as she seemed, in all senses of the word, Karen was the original coordinate for your queerness. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Karen Carpenter just stood out as somebody who didn't quite fit in. And I think that a lot of her music sang of unrequited love. A lot of her music focused on not being sure there would be anybody there to love you.
When there's no
And I think that that's the kind of sentiment and feeling that a lot of young LGBT people have, that as a person who has all this love to give and the capacity to love, there is a fear that you'll never find anyone, at least back then. I think that it might be different now, but mm-hmm. that you might never find anyone who would love you back. And I think that she gave voice to that, in many respects, a torch song singer.
Mm.
And yeah. That torchiness and its kind of long association with LGBT cultures is one of the reasons I find Karen Carpenter has such resonance in LGBT communities.
Yeah. Has writing this book changed the way you experience her music?
I think so. I think that I listen differently. I mean, I think that in a way it moved music that had always been in a kind of background, that had always been kind of ambiently present, as I said, almost from in utero to now.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me really listen more carefully to what it was, what it is that lingers with me and that feels important. And it made me hear certain songs anew and really appreciate the kind of skill level there in her voice and also in what the Carpenters did as a band, as musicians.
Mm. Can you give an example of one of those certain songs?
Yeah, I think that on the Close to You album, their first really big breakout record, there's a song called Maybe It's You. And I'd never thought about that song before, and I never really sort of paused to think about how there's a certain level of irony and cruelty to it, and that also just the richness again of the harmonies. It's a minor song in the Carpenters canon, but you know, that, like, when I hear it now, it's just bursting with so much angst, possibility, emotion, and it's become my new favorite in the course of listening again for this project.
Rising on the shore, the ocean came, walks among the waves of thought, his love for me.
Karen Carpenter died on February 4th, 1983. She was only 32. You were still young when she passed. Can you take me back to how you found out?
I was still 9 years old. My family and I were in the middle of making our preparations to leave the Philippines and move to Riverside, California, where my stepdad grew up. So his mother became ill, and so we had to kind of leave the Philippines abruptly and come and help take care of her in Riverside. And we were at a travel agency in the kind of Manila's Chinatown district, Little Ongpin. And I just remember seeing on the front page of the newspaper, Filipino newspaper, that Karen Carpenter dies, you know, at 32. Wow. And I remember it really struck me because, you know, when the person who you're named after dies, especially when they die young, you mm-hmm. feel like, I don't know, that somehow that is related to you and your experience, et cetera, in some way. And so I remember it really, as I say in the book, it really inaugurated my fear of mortality.
What is Karen Carpenter's legacy?
I think that she really carved out a place for female vocalists. Mm. She's seen as one of the great voices of all time. Mm. And I think that that is just undeniable. There is something, you know, you can't train that. It's something that she just remarkably had as a gift that she was born with. At the same time, you know, I think that when we think about some of the other singers who we know for their voice and the quality of that voice who've come since Karen Carpenter, we can see that legacy. We can see that they're also misfits in their own way. I'm thinking of people who've spoken openly about emulating Karen Carpenter, like Katie Lang, for
yes.
example.
Yes.
And so I do think that, you know, she has a much broader, richer afterlife. I think that in her time, she was very much kind of perceived to exist within a very hermetically sealed world and environment, in a kind of wholesome one. And I think that since she passed, and since people learned more about her suffering in various ways, that we've come to understand she had a much more complex, a richer, sadder, and sometimes also different life than we anticipated.
Karen Tongson, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We're lost in this masquerade.
Karen Tongson is the author of Why Karen Carpenter Matters. Find out more about Karen and Karen Carpenter at WPR.org/beta.
I think it's up there with I Love Lucy, Cheers, and Seinfeld. Is sort of a timeless show that'll be funny now and even 50 years.
Author Andy Green joins us to talk about the staying power of The Office. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The website The Ringer recently ran a bracket to determine the best TV character of the century. And the winner was Michael Scott, Steve Carell's character from the mid-aughts NBC sitcom, The Office. Ironically, it was this very character that almost got The Office canceled after its first season, according to Rolling Stone's Andy Green. This is one of the many fascinating facts Andy covers in his oral history, The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. That subtitle may sound like a hyperbolic boast, so we Skyped him to find out more. Andy says in 2005, the sitcom was in desperate need of a reboot.
Sitcoms of the time were just all Friends knockoffs. It was a really awful time for sitcoms in the early aughts. That Friends was so popular, but inspired all of these really boring paint-by-numbers shows about beautiful young people who were living in giant apartments all in New York City. Mm. And it felt so unmoored into reality. It felt so fake that when The Office came, as goofy as the show was, it was a slice of real life in a way. It was so refreshing that there was no laugh track. And there was no music, and they didn't look like models. It was just so against the grain of most shows at the time, that there's a hunger to see that.
The Office is based on the British BBC TV series of the same name. It was created by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, and it starred Ricky as David Brent. How did the American version happen?
It was somewhat by coincidence. There is a TV executive that is named Ben Silverman that was in London, and he was going through the channels, and he saw the show, and he was confused for a few minutes because he thought it was real. But he realized it was fake, and he couldn't stop laughing. It was so clever.
The man who gives the jobs in the warehouse is a personal friend of mine. All right? Sammy, you old slag. It's the Brentmeister General. Have you ever tried the forklift driver's job? No, good. Don't bother. I've got the man here. He's perfect. Has he passed his forklift driver's tests? He gives the tests. Yeah. We'll get a CV over to you this afternoon. Oh, is Elaine? She left you yet? Yeah. All right, see you then. She has left him. I forgot about that.
He called Ricky up. They met at a Starbucks, and he bought the rights to the show. And he shopped it around, and so many networks, they turned it down. It was so different that they didn't want it. But he got NBC to be bold and to buy a pilot.
Greg Daniels worked on Saturday Night Live, The Simpsons, and King of the Hill before he ended up in charge of the American adaptation of The Office. What was it about Greg that made him the right guy for the job?
Hey, he's really funny and a great writer. He wrote some of the best episodes of The Simpsons, and he ran King of the Hill. And if you watch that show, you can feel some vibes of The Office in King of the Hill. It's so different than most cartoon shows. It's just a regular family in the middle of Texas. They're very working class.
Firm, but with a little give. Yep, these are medium rare.
What if somebody wants theirs well done?
We ask them politely yet firmly to leave.
And the show it felt so realistic, and that same vibe was brought to The Office by Greg Daniels.
Mm-hmm. It kind of makes me think, as you were answering that, it made me think of the famous Alfred Hitchcock quote about drama is life with the dull bits cut out. And it seems to me, as you were talking about King of the Hill and to a certain extent The Office, they would leave some of those dull bits in and milk them for comedy.
Yeah, and that's crucial because the rhythm of most sitcoms for 50 years was almost the sing-song rhythm of line, zinger, laugh track, line, zinger, laugh track. Mm-hmm. It was so predictable and very played out, and there was no awkward silences. There were no boring parts. But when I interviewed Ricky Gervais, he told me that he was fascinated by awkwardness in real life and fascinated by embarrassment and jokes that fall flat, and just tension of silence. And silence is very funny if it's used effectively. But that's hard to do on a sitcom where you have 21 minutes and you're trying to appeal to the widest possible audience. But Greg and the Office gang, they were bold enough to kind of use silence in very smart ways.
What kind of resistance did Greg Daniels and Ben Silverman face when they were trying to convince NBC executives that this show would work?
It was a show that didn't have stars. It took place in a very unglamorous part of the country at a very unglamorous job. And you couldn't think of a more boring premise for a show for the mundane lives of struggling workers at a failing paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And back in 2003 and 4, when it was being shopped around, it was the tail end of sort of the pre-streaming era and even the pre-cable era for a lot of shows, where the networks still had huge audiences. And to take a risk on a show that different was just such a crazy idea that Fox and CBS and ABC and HBO all either said no or we'll think about it, but with big changes. And on the big change that they all wanted, they wanted a laugh track. And they wanted it to be multicam, and they refused.
What part do you think the mockumentary format played in the success of The Office?
I think it was just a great and different way to present a show. It was inspired by reality shows that were popping up at the time, and it was even filmed by the same camera team that did Survivor. And sort of, and just taking that language of the reality show where you see a scene with sort of a shaky camera, and then you see a talking head interview where they're talking about the inner dialogue of that moment, was such a unique way just to present a sitcom that people, that they were fascinated by it.
Yeah, and that's one of the most interesting, one of many interesting things I learned from your book is about having the Survivor camera crew to shoot The Office. So that played a huge part, I would say, in the success of the show.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And I spoke to that camera team, and it was fascinating to me that they didn't watch rehearsal, really, that they would just go in there and they shoot it the same way that they shot Survivor, by just capturing things as it happened.
Yeah. Let's talk about the pilot of the American version of The Office. How did that turn out?
It was a disaster, and they all regret it. They very foolishly decided to do almost a shot-for-shot remake of the British Office. And it forced Steve Carell to do a sort of impersonation of Ricky Gervais. And the Gervais character, which was named David Brent, was really aggressive, really cruel, and he had no real redeeming qualities. So he mock fires Pam in the pilot, who is his secretary, and she's sobbing and she's heartbroken, and he's laughing at her.
You've an ex-punk! Surprise! It's a joke! We were joking around! See? Okay, he was in on it. He was my accomplice, and there was just kind of a morale booster thing, and we were showing the new guy around, kind of giving him the feel of the place. So... We totally got you.
You're a jerk.
I don't know about that.
Test audiences and the actual audiences, they hated it. It just didn't work, and the critics just tore it to bits.
So NBC picks up The Office for 5 more episodes, and the first of these 5 is called Diversity Day. How did Diversity Day turn out?
That was groundbreaking, and that was the first time that they did their own thing, which was obviously very early, and they tackled race in a very head-on way, and it was really bold. And if you watch it now, it's kind of shocking. You've seen Michael Scott use the N-word numerous times. I mean, it's a Chris Rock bit that he's quoting, but it's still, it's intense. It's not the sort of thing that would fly these days, perhaps, and with good reason, maybe. But it's also very funny in how shocking it is. And it was sort of the first sign that the show was going to go in its own direction. But it still had a ways to go. It was still, they had a major problem at that point still, that Michael Scott was still cruel and vindictive and openly racist and just not a good guy.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest changes that the writers made from the first season to the second season was rejigging Steve Carell's character, the boss, Michael Scott. As you mentioned, he was abrasive and... kind of a bully and not seen as a good guy. How did they make those changes to the character?
Well, they knew they had to do something because the show was almost canceled and the audiences, they hated Michael Scott. But they didn't know quite what to do until that summer when they saw The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which came out in the summer of 05, which was between season 1 and 2. And they saw Steve Carell play a character who was very lonely, very sad, and just living a sort of desperate life. But he infused the character with so much warmth that you loved the guy, that you felt bad for him, that you really felt this person's pain.
You know what? I'm a virgin too. Hey, that's...
We're virgins too.
Yeah.
No, you know what? It's a personal choice, and I don't think it's weird at all.
Okay, I can't listen to any more of this because it's making me sick, so bye.
You can get this information on your website, right?
Oh, yes.
Thanks. Nice meeting everybody.
And they brought a lot of those characteristics into the retooled Michael Scott in the second season. They made a big point of showing that he's a man who has no friends, who has no family, yearns for more, and sees his colleagues as his friends and his family. And if you understand that, then you forgive a lot of his bad parts because you realize he's just acting out.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Dwight Schrute. Unlike the rest of the Dunder Mifflin universe, Rainn Wilson's portrayal of Dwight worked well right from the start. Can you tell us about Dwight and the role that he played in the show?
Yeah, sure. It's a very different kind of character because so many of the characters, they feel grounded in reality. They feel like people that you might know. Dwight, he's sort of this quasi-Amish beet farmer who's into heavy metal and Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. He's just this wild mass of contradictions that make no sense if you think about them. And he's a nerd, but he's a ladies' man. I mean, there's all these weird things that they threw in there, but Rain is so clever and so funny that he made it seem real. And it's just this brilliant character.
Mm-hmm. What was it about the way Rainn Wilson portrayed Dwight that made the character so funny?
He made him just sort of person who craves authority, who's almost a fascist, who just looks to Michael as a god. He has this blind obedience to this buffoon.
Okay, first, let's go over some parameters. How many people can I fire?
None. You're picking a healthcare plan.
Okay, we'll table that for the time being. Two, I'm gonna need an office. I think the conference room should be fine.
You can use the conference room as a temporary workspace. You can use it.
Thank you.
So it created an amazing dynamic of this idiot boss who's actually a good salesman, which is a weird thing, but who's a terrible boss, and his underling is this just really bizarre nerd who worships him and his power. And it was this amazing dynamic that worked for 7 seasons.
Larry Wilmore was a staff writer for a couple of seasons, and he says that although The Office looks like a workplace show, it's really a romantic comedy. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think the hook of so many people was the Jim and Pam romance. It's the through line of the key second season and the third season. And it was it's why people kept tuning in just to see what would happen. And John Krasinski and Jenna Fischer were so talented at conveying a sort of yearning for each other that they couldn't act on because she was engaged to a warehouse worker.
Solitaire?
Yeah, free sale.
We're 6 on 7.
I know, I saw that.
So then why didn't you do it?
I'm saving that because I like it when the cards go.
Who doesn't love that?
It was just this incredible romance that was very compelling.
Steve Carell left The Office after the 7th season. The show continued for 2 more seasons. How well do you think the show held up after Steve left?
It was a complete disaster. I mean, I was told by a writer in that era that they realized later that he was a load-bearing character. And if you take out that supporting wall, the entire thing, it just fell down. But I would argue that even before he left, the show was showing some rust. That by the 7th season, they've lost a bunch of the best writers, and Greg Daniels left to go run Parks and Rec. So if you watch season 7, it's full of duds. The tone changed. It was more sitcom-y. It was not as funny. It was showing its age. And by this point, Pam and Jim are married to each other, and they have a child, and that tension is gone. And then Steve Carell leaves, and it was just an absolute disaster. It did not work.
The Office is the #1 most watched acquired show on Netflix. Why do you think it's still so popular 15 years after it debuted?
I think partially it's just very, very funny. And Peak TV, it's produced so many great shows and so many great dramas and mysteries and documentaries and thrillers, but very few great sitcoms. And very few shows that are just that funny. So the ability to just go on Netflix and binge on 9 seasons of a show that's that clever and that's relatable is just such a gift now to so many people.
The subtitle of your book is The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s. But let's open it up even more. Where do you think The Office ranks among the greatest sitcoms of all time?
I think top 5. I think it's up there with I Love Lucy, Cheers, and Seinfeld. It's sort of a timeless show that'll be funny now and even 50 years.
Yeah. Andy Green, thank you very much.
Sure, of course. It was very nice being here.
Andy Green is a senior writer for Rolling Stone and the author of The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. Find out more at wpr.org/beta.
Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Barry Sonnenfeld, Karen Tongson, and Andy Green. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
He has his Netflix sent here to the office and he watches them in pieces when things are slow.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Is there no limit to what he won't notice?
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I always appreciate constructive criticism about my job performance. I thrive on it.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Take care and stay safe out there. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
Don't think of it as a demotion, just think of it as a promotion to a lower level.